You're listening to The Zesty Garden. It's the Yes You Can segment. Adri Roberts is Cache County's Extension Family and Consumer Sciences Agent. And today we're going to talk about breakfast and why it's the most important meal. I just can't skip it like I did this morning.
No, you can't skip breakfast. It's really important. It's called break fast. So your body has been fasting probably for at least 12 hours and it needs some nourishment to get going. And so we highly recommend that you have some breakfast. But you don't have to have the same bowl of Cheerios every morning. You can vary it up a little bit. We have, in our office, we have a class called Breakfast, the most important meal of the day. And we show you some great, fun recipes. We have a maple walnut flaxseed pancake mix.
After my wife's heart on that one.
Well, she needs to come to this class because it is fabulous. And it's got the walnuts in, which are great for you. It's got the flaxseed in. But you also put a little bit of syrup in the actual mix. So it flavors that mix up, the pancake up, and then you don't have to add so much syrup for the top. So you're cutting down on sugar too. But there's just a lot of creative things that you can do for breakfast that's just a little bit different. And if you think about some of the things that we eat for breakfast, like a white flour pancake, I mean, what nutrition is in there? Not much. So we have a breakfast cookie that is a boiled raisin, oatmeal, whole wheat flour, bean puree cookie that you can make ahead of time. You can freeze it in logs, and then in the morning you can get up and just slice off a few slices of that cookie, bake it up fresh, send it out the door with the kids on their way to school. They'll think it's great. They may stick their nose up at raisins, but they're hungry in the morning and they'll eat those raisins.
Well, and just saying the word, kids, would you like some cookies for breakfast?
Yeah.
What?
Okay.
We'll have those. So I've noticed that with my own body, I need protein in the morning to really help me get through the day. And things like cream of wheat and even oatmeal to a certain extent don't quite last for me. So I usually, we have chickens, so eggs are pretty regularly available. So some mornings I'll have an egg and I've got to make sure I've got some kind of protein that's in my diet. Is that just me or does that seem to, protein tend to stick around?
Protein tends to stick around. And I thought it was really interesting the other day. Dr. Oz was on TV and he said, have an egg. It's good. It's all right. It's especially children really benefit from having an egg or two for breakfast. I think if you talk to teachers, you can definitely tell the kids who had the bowl of Cheerios or Fruit Loops and the kids who had an egg and a piece of toast.
I mean, as much as I used to eat Fruit Loops and that sort of thing, I mean, Waffle Crisp was my cereal to go for if I was doing cereal, but it doesn't stick around, and it just leaves you just a little bit. I don't know if the tests show that this really makes you hyper or not, but I'll go up and then just drop,
right?
Because my body's used it up.
Well, and the fat in the egg or the breakfast meat or the butter you put on your toast or whatever will stay with you most of the morning, and help you not feel so hungry either. So you do need a little bit of fat along the lines there, so that egg isn't bad at all.
And then what about foods that would have more fiber in them? I mean, that the whole grain oats would be better than the quick oats, wouldn't they?
They are. They are a little bit better for you because they make your body work harder because they're harder to digest. So we have a fabulous granola recipe that is fairly low in fat, has a little bit of canola oil and some honey and a lot of oats and nuts and wheat germ and things like that. So if you take that, I love to make big batches of it and just put them into little Ziploc bags. And then my kids will just take them with them. My kids will sit and eat a cup of granola dry while they're watching TV. And so think things through like that. What do they like? And how can you make it so that it's a breakfast food and it's convenient and it's fast for you? So anything that you can make ahead of time on the weekends will make that breakfast much easier. I remember when I had kids at home how hard that get out the door time is. And a lot of times we lack in the breakfast area because that's a least priority sometimes. So plan ahead and get organized. That helps.
We've limited in our household cereal to just two mornings a week. And one of those is on the weekend.
Okay.
So the rest of the time we have to be a little bit more creative and you know, my son doesn't always like everything that's presented, but he always tries it. And one of the things I just absolutely love, and I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, was a recipe that my wife and I got from our honeymoon cottage when we were on the Oregon coast. Mm-hmm. And it's baked apple oatmeal.
Ooh.
And it has walnuts in it, just a little bit of a cinnamon. I don't think it's got, does it have any sugar in it at all? Anyway, you can bake and make it up dry. And then add the apples, or like we like to do during peach season, change it to baked peach oatmeal.
Ooh, yeah.
And then it's really easy to throw into this little baking dish, and oh, just absolutely delicious. And I had some that I brought to work and forgot it was there for 2 days. And then when I opened up the fridge and saw it, it was like, oh, gold. I just struck gold. So you can find really good recipes that your family will eat. And in this case, because of the walnuts and the fiber and the whole oats, it tends to stick around a little bit longer,
right.
At least last me to lunch.
Yeah. So. We have a cinnamon oatmeal pancake mix that is very popular. We use them in a lot of our cooking classes. And that's a huge, huge batch of pancakes. And you can only honestly hold one pancake. It is very filling, has a lot of fiber in. And, you know, if you give that to your child and an egg in the morning, man, they're going to be fine for a while.
And as far as something to drink in the morning, what do you recommend? I know some of the juices, even though they say they're 100% juice, it's still high in sugar.
Right. Well, I think that the nutrition experts are now saying it's best to have your vegetables or fruits as a whole fruit or vegetable. Juice is kind of a last resort. It's better they're getting juice than nothing. But if you can hand them a banana or whatever, you know, a real orange, a real apple, it's much better than those juices. And you have to look very carefully at those juice labels, like you said, because a lot of them have the corn syrup ad, or they'll call it a cranberry juice cocktail. That's a sign that's
or
not.
Or drink.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a sign that it's not the fruit juice or the vegetable juice. So just read labels really carefully so you're sure you're getting the right nutrition.
If you drink orange juice, does it make much difference to get the calcium fortified or the ones with the extra pulp?
You know, it will add more fiber. I do think that for us women folks, that all the calcium we can get is really important, because osteoporosis is a sad, sad disease. And so I always pick up the calcium orange juice, just because I figure it can't hurt to add a little more calcium. So it's kind of up to you. But if you love your women, I would get the calcium type.
Okay. You've been listening to Adri Roberts. This is our Yes You Can segment. Adri is Cache County's Extension Family and Consumer Sciences Agent. Thanks for coming in.
You bet. Thanks.
And welcome to this segment of the program. Thank you to Adri for being in and talking about breakfast. And now I have Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden, and we're going to talk about vegetables. Or flowers, if you want, I guess, or whatever you want to talk about.
Or soil. Or
And he's live in studio.
We can talk about, yeah.
So call us at our toll-free number, 1-800-826-1495. And all of those that keep coming up to me and saying, well, I heard you talk about this on the program, and then you ask me a question. Well, you call into this program right now and call in with your question. 800-826-1495. Or send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com.
We'll even provide an answer for the question, too,
you know,
for the most part.
For free.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing. It's amazing. This is just such an exciting, fun time of year, because there's just so much potential for upcoming spring, and we've got amazing weather for January.
Well, that's just it. I keep thinking, wow, if this just keeps lasting and just gradually warming up, usually February 1st is about 10th, somewhere in there. It's like it's the coldest it's ever going to get, and then it starts warming up from there. So
traditionally, I think we have a lot of snow that comes in February, but when you think about all the ice that's not there right now, that we usually have underneath all that snow that comes in February, that's what takes forever to melt off. It's not the snow that I'm positive we're going to get inches and possibly even feet of snow in February. It's just on the horizon. But there's no layer of ice underneath that's going to take a month to melt off. And so we could have, you know, clear soil to play with the 1st of March like we did last year, and I won't complain.
If I wanted to go out and plug my lawn, I could do it right now.
It's
what I'm saying is it's
melted
hard.
Off, but I went out to do a soil test last Saturday, and my soil was so hard I couldn't.
Oh, still
I had to chisel. I had to chisel, yeah. With the rain that we got this week, it may have softened like the top little layer up a little bit, but we really had to get the ice auger out to get a good soil sample. I was doing a test for one of my classes. I was going to show them how to do a test at home and test for nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. And Saturday morning, I was like, oh, let's go get some soil out of the garden. You know, no problem. You know, it was like scraping.
Like ice fishing?
It was scraping the concrete.
So you have an auger?
So you might not get a very good plug on your soil right now.
Okay, hold on.
But, I mean, it's exciting. I mean, I've got people coming in the store that want to, like, plant stuff, and they're just excited. But it's a great time to start some things indoors, and it's a great time to plan your garden, and it's a good time to start researching some new varieties to try out. And
well, it's hard,
a lot of fun stuff
to not want to plant, because you've had even in a winter like this one where you haven't had that much cold and that much snow to deal with, those darn gardening catalogs keep arriving in the mail, and they just get you all excited.
You know, if you got your bulbs planted in October, that's probably the last thing you planted. And here we've got November, December, January, and we're going to be into February here real soon. And it's like 3-4 months before you've really done anything out in the yard. So I start getting that itch.
I'm going to have tulips probably popping up, at least the leaves, on the south side of my house in about 3 weeks.
That's a possibility. Right now, I've got a lot of customers that are really excited about doing microgreens, and we are showing them how to do microgreens. I've got little kits that just make it. You don't have to have a 70-degree temperature to do microgreens. I mean, you need...
Well, most of the greens, like a lot of the greens, they will like germinate, cooler temperatures.
They will germinate at 40 to 45-degree soil temperature. So you can basically, with a light, with a full-spectrum light, you can stick it on a shelf in the basement and start your own microgreens and have your own fresh greens to eat inside. And it takes about 3 to 4 weeks, and you cut them off, and in 2 weeks they're right back again, and you cut them again. And I mean, super, super easy to have fresh, homegrown stuff inside your house right now. And I've got all the seeds, all kinds of different varieties of stuff you can grow, and just super easy to do.
So how much do you need to have in order to have a good sized salad?
A couple years back, we did microgreens for a local caterer, and he was using them to do greens for sandwiches, and we grew like 10 flats for him, and he was probably getting, I would say 20.
Did you say 10 flats?
10 flats, yeah, and the flats are 10 inches by 20 inches, so it's a standard, growing flat. I would say he was probably getting between 20 and 30 servings for full 12-inch, hoagie sandwiches off of it. So probably salad servings off of a 10 by 20, I'll bet you could get easily 15 to 20 off. It depends on how much lettuce you want in your salad, So, but the nice thing about these is it's a mix. And so you can take an iceberg lettuce mix, and then you can add your own fresh greens in with it and supplement it and get a lot more nutrition out of the greens that you just grew. But you can add a little bit more substance to it with a romaine lettuce or something you can buy, inexpensively at the grocery store. But then you've got all your fresh greens that you've grown, and you can do, there's a lot of different herbs you can do that give you great flavors, and you can do arugulas and mustards and kales and, all kinds of stuff.
Would you do a mesclun mix?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I'm thinking, I just say no to iceberg. I want flavor, so I do a mesclun mix out in the garden.
You can get a really inexpensive couple heads of romaine, at the grocery store, and then add all your fresh greens into it, and you've got just like a primo, high quality, nice fresh green mix that you can just cut and eat, and then it just miraculously grows back again. You get to cut it and eat it again.
Well, we have Magic Mark in studio, and I say that because we have our first phone call. It's from Rachel in Vernal. Hi, Rachel. How can we help?
I have a question. I'm in a rental, so I have to do a lot of planting in pots, and I want to have a more successful growing year with tomatoes because Vernal has a very short growing season because it stays cold forever.
Longer. Yeah, absolutely.
What's my best bet at growing a more successful tomato, like buy that starts and start them inside, certain brands that would do better. I've kind of consulted like Burpee and things like that, but I'm not being very successful with my tomatoes.
Right, right. There are certain varieties that grow better in containers than others. And a lot of times you can buy those already grown at your local nursery. I'm not really familiar with a lot of the nurseries there in Vernal, so I'm sorry I can't help you that way. But
there isn't any major.
Yeah, you can grow your own and pick your own varieties that way, because a lot of times the greenhouse growers will kind of stick with the mainstream stuff, and they'll try a few different heirlooms and a few different new varieties. But if there's something that you really like, you can start them yourself indoors very easily in a very small area. I mean, we'll do ours in little small containers. They don't have to take up a whole lot of area, especially if you're only doing maybe two or three plants in pots. Is that what you're going to grow?
I got one of the kind of, it looks like the cutoff barrels.
Sure.
I think I put two in, and it was enough to put a cage in it to keep for structure. But do you have any suggestions on brands or hybrids that would maybe do better?
Absolutely. So I'll recommend a couple of varieties that do really well in containers for you. The trick to doing well in containers, and I've had great success growing plants, especially tomatoes, in containers. The trick is you got to start with the best potting soil you can find. The better your soil, the more successful you're going to be, because tomatoes are really picky when it comes to soil. Make sure you get a soil that has no bark in it. You need just peat moss, vermiculite, perlite, maybe coconut core, and maybe some humate, and maybe a slow release fertilizer in there. Don't get a soil that has bark in it. It will cause problems with your tomatoes.
So if you pick up something at the store and you come home and it's kind of clumpy, almost like it's clayish. Like, take it right back to the store.
It's the weight. If you pick up the bag and it's heavy, that's a problem. Unless it's like heavy from moisture. You know, if it's got water, you know, if it's picked up a little bit of moisture, it's gonna hold that moisture weight. But if you look on the ingredients on the bag, it'll always tell you what's in there. If bark is one of the higher ingredients, don't get it.
So that's a filler.
It's a filler. Yeah, it's just wasted space. It's to make the mix less expensive.
It's like Milo and birdseed.
it really is. I won't mention any names on the radio since this is an open forum, but don't get the bag that's like yellow and green.
Okay.
You know, because it is like 50% bark, and it's like the worst soil I've ever seen.
So, and don't get your garden soil to put in.
Oh, yeah. Don't use garden soil, because it'll just turn into a brick. Yeah, it's not made for growing in containers. It's made for growing out in your flower beds or in your garden. So if you've got a big whiskey barrel that you're growing in, you know, put 6, 12 inches of bark down the bottom. I mean, big, chunky, large landscaping bark, not shredded bark, but, you know, landscaping bark.
Just for drainage.
For good drainage, yeah. And it keeps your planter lighter so you can move it later. Because a lot of my customers will put gravel or rocks in there, which is great drainage, but man, you can't move it. I mean, it's so heavy. So big chunky bark down on the bottom. Just leave yourself 12 to 16 inches of space for your soil, and that's the depth that those tomatoes are going to need. And we're going to put the best quality potting soil in there, really high in peat moss, coconut core, vermiculite, you know, all the good stuff. And that's the best base to start off with.
What about the fertilizer? Because what you're getting doesn't have anything in it.
Yeah, you got to fertilize like crazy. We'll get to the fertilizer.
Okay.
I'm not taking too much time, am I?
No.
You like good? Okay. All right.
I'm fine. All about learning
well,
what
is,
I need
this
to
is
do
a great,
better.
This is a great question, because it doesn't apply just to tomatoes. It applies to everything you grow in the container. I mean, so it's not just tomatoes we're talking about. So everybody that's listening, whatever you want to grow in those containers, this will make you much more successful. For varieties, I would definitely recommend some determinate varieties. Determinate means that the plant growth habit is going to stay much more compact, and it's going to be easier for you to handle in a container, especially on a patio. So probably Celebrity would be one of my favorites. And a Celebrity is just a great all-around tomato. It's large, around 16 ounces.
I grow that one in my garden. I love it because it's great for canning.
It's a great, great tomato. You can do so many different things with it. Another one of our favorites is called Best Boy, and it's a little bit of a cross between Better Boy and I can't remember what its other parent is.
Best something.
Yeah, it's a Bonnie Best. It might be Bonnie Best, but that's a great tomato too. Also very compact, but maybe even a little larger fruit than the Celebrity, but an early producer. Comes on really quick. And I always like doing a cherry tomato in a planter, because they just go nuts. And so I usually do Sweet Baby Girl or Sun Sugar, and those are excellent also. But I don't think you'd be I don't think you'd be disappointed with either Celebrity or the Best Boy. Those would be excellent for those containers.
Okay.
And Celebrity is one that you usually can find at a
Celebrity
store. Oh,
Celebrity's really common. Best Boy is not as easy to find, but we have all these seeds available in really small quantities if you need them, or in large quantities. And we ship to people all over the state and all over the place. And our prices are much, much less expensive than Burpee.
Okay.
And the quality is amazing.
Would you recommend her planting indoors first, or just trying to get the plants?
I would maybe do a little bit of both and see what happens, because if you're unsuccessful starting your own, which is really inexpensive and easy to do, you can always fall back on one that somebody else has grown. But it's kind of fun to grow your own. If you're doing like 30 or 40 different plants, I'd probably just say go ahead and buy them. It's easier to just let somebody else grow them. But if you're just going to do a few here and there, I think it'd be kind of fun to try. For fertilizer, actually probably want to start your tomatoes for vernal. You're a little bit later than us. I would probably recommend the end of March. Start your seedlings inside, probably about the middle to the end of March, because we don't want them too large to transplant out, because sometimes they don't transplant nearly as well. But that kind of transitions into what fertilizer to use. The best starting solution that I've ever used is called Kangaroots. And the Kangaroots is made by a company called Fox Farm. And it's got beneficial microbes, mycorrhiza, all kinds of great natural biologicals and natural fertilizers in there. And it will make your plants get established faster than anything I've ever used. It's amazing.
Okay, that sounds great.
Yeah, and so it's called Kangaroots. And then once you get them established into their new location, fertilize them really frequently. I'm talking weekly, with a good balanced fertilizer.
So don't use something like Osmocote.
The Osmocote's not so bad, but in a container like that, you have to water really frequently, mm-hmm. and so it'll leach a lot of the nutrient out. And Osmocote breaks down a little bit every time you water it. So instead of lasting for 3 or 4 months, it's really going to last about a month to 2 months. You got to use it a little bit more frequently. But to really make those plants go like crazy, you want to use a water-soluble liquid fertilizer and do it weekly on those plants. Get on the leaves and let them pick it up through the root system as well, too. And there's some great ones out there. Nutri-Green from Bicor, which is made right here in Logan. Yeah, that's one of our all-time favorites. Grow Big, also from Fox Farm, is excellent for the tomatoes. We've done some seaweed, some kelp and fish combos that are excellent. There's a ton of really good ones out there for you to try. So just be consistent with the fertilizer. Otherwise, your plants will just kind of stagnate and sit there.
And full sun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are the keys. I mean, you've got the key combination to make those successful.
Great. Anything else?
Well, no, I was looking for a little bit of suggestion and hoping maybe you had better ideas than I came up with for a more successful tomato crop this year.
There we go. I hope that works for you.
Good luck to you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rachel.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling. If you'd like to join our conversation, Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden is in studio. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. We're going to take a quick break and then come back for about another 15 minutes with Mark Anderson, so stay tuned. Welcome back to the second half of The Zesty Garden. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden is in studio with me today. And if you'd like to join our conversation with your question or comment, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can go online, send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So I was just talking with you there during the break. Would you put a whiskey barrel along the edge of your driveway to try to get more heat?
Yeah.
Even in a place like Vernal where temperatures are going to go up to 100. Will
they
that make
are.
It too hot?
Not too hot. We do that all the time, especially if we want to get some early tomatoes, kind of impress the neighbors and have a plant that's producing by 24th of July, which is not uncommon to have a nice big, not just a early girl, 4th of July, small, teeny, tight, tomato, but I mean to get like a real big tomato. We'll do them in containers on the driveway because it just generates all that extra heat. The trick is to make sure your pot's large enough that it will hold the moisture properly and not dry out completely in one day. We're still watering them daily, to keep them moist and keep them well hydrated. But if your planters are too small, they'll dry out really quickly in a hot spot like that. But in a whiskey barrel, that takes more time. Sometimes they can even go 2 or 3 days between waterings because they'll retain that extra moisture.
I have a lot of smaller pots sitting on the back porch along with a whiskey barrel.
Yeah.
And that's my son's job. He's got the water wand. And
sure,
it goes up
sure.
and down yeah. and watering the plants
yeah.
every day.
The big trend right now in gardening, especially in smaller areas, and if you've got a smaller backyard, is doing some of the wall planters. You know, if you've seen those where you do, you know, like green wall and stuff, which is really cool. But think about how small those containers are. They're up off the ground. If you're in a windy location,
like a couple times a day.
Oh my gosh, you got to water them like crazy. If it's
either that or have some kind of an emitter on it.
If it's 90 to 95 degrees outside and you're windy, like it is at my house, You're watering those suckers 2 or 3 times a day to keep them moist because they're drying out that fast. I mean, it's really made for coastal California and Oregon.
It works there,
you know, backyards where it's kind of moist and humid and just doesn't get as hot as we get in the desert.
Well, know, so. How do they get enough light? Because if it's on a wall,
yeah.
it's not going to be well, getting either morning
a,
light.
You have them either on a south wall or on a west or a east wall, and they'll get plenty of light. The hard part
it's
for
not
us,
too intense.
No, the hard part for us around here is just keeping them moist. Yeah, because it just between the wind and the dry air. I mean, they're up in circulation, air circulation, and the containers are smaller. I mean, they just dry out really quickly. So it's a great concept. It's a really fun idea. Just be practical if you're trying to do it. It's going to take extra water to keep those guys happy.
Well, let's take a look at some new concepts. You're always testing things in your own garden.
Yeah.
Naturally, just so you can see if it actually works before
yeah.
you sell it.
Yeah, for sure.
What are you seeing? What trends are you seeing in the last year?
You know, I haven't seen a whole lot of new variety of vegetables coming out, and they just announced.
Well, if anything, they're being taken off the market.
I know they're discontinuing so many different things right now. So, but there are some new breeders that are really starting to innovate and come up with some new things. But I think they're in the pipeline and we haven't seen a lot of those new varieties yet. I think there's some new pepper varieties that have come out the last, probably the last 6 months, but I don't think they're available for next year. So I'm kind of scratching my head trying to think of what's really new and exciting that we've seen for this coming spring.
Let me ask you one question. If you had one annual, I mean, of course you want to do more than that, but if you had one annual to tell the listeners to plant, what would it be? I know for me, it's going to be a profusion zinnia.
Yeah.
I love profusion zinnias. I don't have to do anything
really
with them. They get mounded up to like a foot and a half tall,
yeah.
and I don't have to deadhead them, and they look absolutely wonderful.
Yep.
So that's my annual.
Yep. I love profusion zinnias. That's definitely one of my favorites. I have, I think I've got 5 different colors coming in seed this year if you want to start some of your own.
They still have the cherry. They still have, it's like rocket orange or something, and there's a yellow.
They're a little bit more expensive than your standard zinnia, of course, but they produce like crazy. I mean, they just flower and flower, and they don't get mildew, so it's a great variety.
Take the heat?
Yeah, they
do. If it does dry a little bit, they'll bounce right back.
I still love Million Bells. I love the Million Bells. So it's a little small flower, looks like a little mini petunia, and they will cascade 2 to 3 feet.
That's what those are called.
They just produce like crazy. It's a Calibrachoa.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Calibrachoa is its scientific botanical name, and they're called Million Bells. And
is there an orange?
Oh, there's tons of different colors now. Yeah, tons of different colors. But they just are great producers. They can handle the heat. You get some nice trailing cascade out of them, and if you keep them well fertilized, they'll just bloom all summer for you. It's bloom and bloom and bloom. And very little bug or disease problems. You know, maybe aphids. I'll get aphids a little bit. But everything gets aphids. So
yeah.
If it's got sap in it, it gets aphids. So
except for the zinnias.
Yeah.
I've never seen aphids on my profusion zinnias.
But they seem to get like spider mites or something. So
Earwigs love them. Now, once a flower gets up and going, usually it's pretty good. But what do you do to take care of earwigs? Because I've seen them just devastate a zinnia flower.
Yeah. And for the most part, if the earwigs are really after a plant, and the zinnias is one that comes to mind, they probably have thrips. The earwigs love thrips. And so they're always all over flowers that have other insect issues.
So that's why I see them up in my dahlias.
In your dahlias, because the dahlias get thrips too.
Yep.
Absolutely. So the earwigs, even though they're a little creepy, they actually are more of a predator for other bugs than they are for the plants.
They eat my clematis.
Yeah.
They, or the flowers anyway.
Yeah.
They'll just...
I'm not saying they can't eat the flowers, but they tend to go after the bugs first.
And I'm still going to squish them.
That's okay. I won't hold it against you, Brian.
When I'm out weeding and all of a sudden I've hit the nest, uh-huh.
I'm like, ah, there's a whole bunch of them right there. Yeah. So, you know, for like new, innovative, you know, fun, crazy, different ideas, the Dynatrap for catching insects is really pretty cool. It came out, I think it was last year, and it's
it catches dinosaurs.
It kind of sounds like it catches dinosaurs, but it is it actually creates its own carbon dioxide, which a lot of flying insects are attracted to, with titanium dioxide and a little electricity, and so it's a continuous source of creates its own carbon dioxide to attract the insects to it, and it's got an ultraviolet light as well too. And when the insects get close to the trap, as they're attracted by either the light or the carbon dioxide, it has a little small fan going inside that creates suction. And as the insects get close to the plant, it just sucks them right in, puts them down into the little trap area, and they can't get out. And you get this amazing bug compost that you can use elsewhere. So very highly nutritious for composting, those bugs are. But Dynatraps, they're really pretty cool. Works great on all kinds of flying insects.
How does it keep the beneficials out?
They are not interested in the ultraviolet light or the carbon dioxide, so it won't bother your bees. Won't bother praying mantids because they're going after other bugs, you know. So
or the lady beetles.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of your moths, especially your detrimental moths that are, you know, laying eggs that turn into caterpillars that are eating your plants, they're attracted by the ultraviolet light, so they're just like right to it. And your mosquitoes and other pesky insects are attracted to the carbon dioxide. So it's a pretty cool little invention.
Before I forget, I'm just remembering that I wanted to talk to you about coal crops because we talked a bit about for the program.
Yeah. So
if you're wanting to get something started, and you just can't you just can't wait, and so what would you?
Yeah.
Was there anything you can plant right now?
So right now is a great time to start your onion plants inside. If you want to do your own onion starts, to transplant those out as soon as the snow melts and your soil's workable. They can go right out. But also your coal crops like broccoli, cabbage, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, kale, they can all be started indoors right now. In 6 weeks, they'll be transplantable. They'll be ready to go outside. And in 6 weeks, we're middle of March. So it's time for those guys to go outside.
How much time would you take to harden them off? Because my concern always is with the coal crops. Because I think one time I put them out I put them out too early, they got hit and it ruined their growing point,
development. Yeah, you can, you know, these plants can handle cold temperatures. They can handle frost. They can handle cold weather. They can handle all that stuff. But when they've been grown inside at 70 degrees for 6 weeks, and then you just like throw them right outside, they're not really happy about that. So usually we'll give them about a week transition time from going inside to outside. And we'll start by putting them out during the day in a partially shady location, so they get a little bit of sun, a little bit of shade, and then bringing them in at night for maybe 3 or 4 days. And then for another 3 or 4 days after that, put them out and then leave them out at night. But I would cover them with like a little frost cloth or something just to kind of help protect them a little bit from the elements. And then transplant them into your garden after a week to 10 days of that hardening off process. But I would still cover them with a hot cap or a frost cloth or, you know, just something to help that transition to get them outside. Because it does get pretty cold sometimes still in March. And we'll get, you know, well below freezing on multiple occasions in March, and sometimes into the teens, and sometimes even below 10. So
start those right now.
Start
indoors.
Right now.
And at what kind of temperatures
if
do they need?
If you have my gardening calendar, it's got it on there.
Yes, it is. I do have
it
that
says,
calendar.
It says this is when you should start them.
Now, that's going to be different for someone in St. George.
It is going to be a little different for someone in St. George, but we can, you know, we can extrapolate a little bit from, you know, from timing. You know, we're about 10 days behind the Wasatch Front. Yeah, you know, and if the farther south you go, things start a little bit sooner. But now's the time to start those crops because they'll be ready to go outside. Tomatoes, I got people coming in and want to start their tomatoes right now. And I was just like, last frost is about the 15th to the 20th of May. So you've got 4 months you got to babysit those guys inside.
I was going through a box and found my old copy of Mark Eubanks' Utah Weather.
Yeah.
And I was looking through that and I'm thinking – boy, some of this information's really old because that was made in like the late 70s, I think, yeah, early 80s. Yeah. Anyway, it talks about for the Logan area, the last recorded frost date was like the first week in June. I'm like, no, I've seen it the 18th since then. So yeah, cooler temperatures can come just about any time. But what I enjoy gardening in Utah is you don't have near the number of insects.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That you have elsewhere, and you don't have now the humidity can be helpful, but it can also be detrimental.
It can also cause problems
as far as some of the different pathogens that can get into
diseases.
The
just love that high humidity. Think how humid it was last summer, because we had that little bit of rain that came through like every month last summer. We'd have that 1 week rainy in June and 1 week rainy in July, which we usually don't get. Yeah. And by August, the humidity levels were so high, everyone had powdery mildew, like crazy. Yeah. I mean, usually that doesn't show up until end of August, 1st of September. And last year, it was the end of July, 1st of August. Everybody was fighting with powdery mildew in us. That's just higher humidity that we're just not used to. Bacterial spot on tomatoes. Did you get the little black spots on your tomatoes?
I didn't.
Oh, I had so many customers that brought in that. And it's easy to control, but it's not a disease we normally deal with. We just usually don't have to do anything because it just doesn't show up. But where it was so humid and mild last summer, by the first part of August, had people bring in tomatoes with just little black spots all over them. And they're like, what's wrong with my
tomato? On the tomato itself.
On the tomato itself. And at that point, there's really nothing you can do because you got to prevent it earlier on. But it's a disease that we rarely ever see in Cache Valley because it's drier. We don't have that humidity, and we don't get those diseases that really develop in that kind of weather. So
is a lot of it the plant just gets stressed, and then if it was kept more looking at blossom end rot, for instance, that's a calcium deficiency,
but
you don't usually see it in the tomatoes if you keep the ground consistent and moisture, not too wet.
It helps,
but not too dry.
Yeah. If you get them too wet, it leaches some of your available calcium out of the soil, and so your plant can't pick it up and use it. But calcium just moves really slow through the plant, so sometimes it just really comes down to a calcium deficiency. But if your plant's healthy and it's consistently watered and it's getting the right temperatures, a lot of times it can fight a lot of those diseases and other problems off all by itself.
Speaking of celebrity, like you did earlier, I plant some other varieties as well, but celebrity is my mainstay because it's so resistant to so many diseases.
Absolutely.
And produces not extra large, but large tomatoes uniform.
Sure.
So if you like to can your tomatoes, this is great. They don't have little knobs all over them.
You know, a lot of the heirloom varieties are really fun to grow, and they've got unique flavors and just really different, but they're not very disease resistant.
They taste great, but
man, sometimes they're hard to grow and they're hard to get to produce, and they just don't produce as much. And so there's drawbacks, and there's reasons why people quit growing them for a while.
So some of each.
Yeah, you got to do a little bit of both. Yeah, absolutely. If you want a really good production, you know, sometimes Brandywine only produces like 10, 15
good
tomatoes.
Grief. Those things took so long.
I
grew them once, and I'm like, they taste great, but gads, I only got like 4 or 5 off of this humongous plant.
Just have to be aware that sometimes you sacrifice production and disease resistance and other qualities to have this really great flavor. Just don't expect them to produce like some of your other tomatoes. And some of the hybrids really have great flavor and really good production and good disease resistance. And I mean, there's a lot of great varieties to try. You just got to try some stuff until you find what you like.
Experiment. That's what I do.
Which kind of leads me into something we're going to shoot for fall. We're going to do kind of a taste test fall festival and have some of our people grow individual varieties. Let them come in and sample them later on. So
okay.
It could be fun. We'll talk about it later. It's in development right now, so but it could be fun.
Mark, thanks.
Thanks, Brian.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Mark Anderson is from Anderson Seed and Garden. Up next, you're going to learn about the world of Middle Earth and the plants that J.R.R. Tolkien has in those books. So stay tuned.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. Quite a long while ago, I read Tolkien's The Hobbit and remember being charmed and fascinated by his imagination. Now they're making films of The Hobbit. I happened upon a book that appealed to me called The Plants of Middle Earth, The Botany and subcreation. And the whole book is devoted to Tolkien's use of flowers in his books. I haven't seen the film and don't know what kind of floristic presentation the filmmaker uses. But the author of the book, Dinah Hazel, is aware that Tolkien exclusively used the plants of this earth. He invented the characters and the creatures, but the plants were from our own earth. It reminded me of a line from Frost, "Earth's a place for love. I don't know where it's likely to go better." And I could substitute flowers and plants of this earth. I don't know where they'd likely to go better. I ran across a Time magazine feature of a couple of years on the making of The Hobbit, and I thought I'd read a little bit of that before I turn to the book. In the middle of an empty lot in a movie studio in Miramar, New Zealand, a bunch of people are standing on a rock. Some of the people are famous, Martin Freeman, for example, who at the moment is doing a little dance to keep warm between takes. It's June, but New Zealand is opposite land, so it's winter here. These are most of the principal cast of The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, the second movie in Peter Jackson's Hobbit trilogy. Freeman plays the hero, Bilbo Baggins. Everyone is dressed in full Middle-earth regalia. I'm hanging around watching them work. Now here's how you turn a human into a dwarf. The dwarfs in the Hobbit movies aren't played by actual dwarfs. They're played by regular-sized people who are made by numerous cinematic sleights of hand to look smaller than they are. But dwarfs aren't just smaller. Their entire bodies are differently proportioned. Their hands and heads are larger relative to their bodies, so the human actors must be rebuilt. It starts with their clothes. Tummies change, says Bob Buck, the movie's costume designer. We build shoulders out, we build their legs out, we build their bums out. Everything is all distorted and manipulated to become a different sort of form. Waistlines were lowered, the actors were issued giant boots, which not only made their feet bigger, but also forced them to walk differently, more dwarfishly. In fact, although it's not obvious on screen, the actors playing dwarfs are almost entirely covered by prosthetics. Their heads are enlarged with latex. Their arms are sheathed in latex sleeves, ending in sausage-fingered latex gloves. Each actor has multiple hands and arms lined up on metal racks, carefully labeled, to the point where the set looks like a Civil War-era field hospital. Viewed up close up, the arms are works of art. The skin is painstakingly modeled and scarred and scabbed. In some cases, there's dirt worked into the lines on the palms. Each arm is carefully furred with dwarf hair. Speaking of which, there is almost no natural hair in The Hobbit. It's not just the dwarfs. Every single character is wearing a wig. Middle Earth is very hairy, says Peter King, who designed the hair and makeup. In the novel, the dwarfs have multicolored beards, which they keep tucked into their belts. King hasn't gone that far, but his dwarfs do have extremely elaborate hairdos and beards. That takes a lot of hair. So King used yak hair instead of human hair. Yak is quite coarse, he explains. It's very crinkly, so it's a great way of bulking things up very quickly, especially facial hair. Being a dwarf requires a certain amount of zen. Summer shoots were so hot that electric cooling units had to be sewn into the costumes. We are, if you like, encased in dwarfism, says Mark Hadlow, who played Dory. You can struggle with the prosthetics and the beard and the mask, the weight of the clothing, the weight of the weapons, the weight of the shoes. But if you accept it inwardly, then it's so easy to play a dwarf. The article concludes, "That's the funny thing about being on the set of The Hobbit. It doesn't put you any closer to Tolkien's magic, but it doesn't put you any further away either. The more technical it all gets, the more everyone ends up relying on their imaginations, the same as all the rest of us do. McKellen isn't just a bit better than most of us. I don't really think of this as fantasy at all, he says. The characters in the story don't think it's fantasy. For them, it's life or death. And then I turn to the book, which connects readers visually to the world of Middle-earth, its cultures, characters, and scenes. Tolkien's use of flowers, herbs, trees, and other flora creates a verisimilitude on Middle-earth and serves important narrative functions. This botanical tour through Middle-earth increases appreciation of Tolkien's contribution as a preserver and transmitter of English cultural expression. The Plants of Middle-earth draws on biography, literary sources, cultural history, and it's unique in using botany as the focal point for examining the complex network of elements that comprise Tolkien's creation. Tolkien was a very erudite man. He studied languages and philosophy and many other intellectual disciplines, but he also was a gardener and he loved plants. Tolkien's plant world is the bridge between Bilbo's garden and ours. Unlike the fantastic warg or balrog, nasturtiums and oaks are easily visualized. Tolkien, the medievalist and philologist, based his Elias on other languages, on those he knew, such as Anglo-Saxon, Middle English, Old Norse, Welsh, Finnish, Latin, and Greek. Curious readers who explore Tolkien's scholarly world may discover that the name for the lofty wood platform, flet, is Middle English for floor. Similarly, his botany derives from familiar surroundings. Despite his magical plants, most of Middle-earth flora comes from Tolkien's England. Middle-earth, itself a Middle English appellation, is at core medieval, and the Lord of the Rings, Tolkien preserves and transmits English cultural expression and value still resonant and relevant to moderns. Readers are usually so absorbed in the tale that they are unaware that their travel through Middle-earth is also a journey through a repository of centuries-old oral and written history. Tolkien drew together the threads of myth, folklore, imagery, and motifs on which English-speaking culture is built and wove them into a great epic for our time. And his botanical life plays a substantial part in that creation. Many of Middle-earth's plants evoke beliefs and powers and qualities found in flora, and Tolkien's landscapes have a character of their own, integral to plot and literary construction. A gardener and plant lover, Tolkien drew on traditional lore to enrich the history of his created world. Yet plants still grace the modern world, appreciated for their beauty and restorative virtues. We can enter part of Tolkien's imaginative vision in our own yards. My California English garden structured herbaceous borders, tangled cottage beds, fragrant herb garden, and withy fence host, many plants found in Middle-earth. Rather than inventing an alien world into which human and familiar characters are introduced as in science fiction, Tolkien created a natural environment that is also supernatural, that is also home to supernatural beings and elements, as in medieval works like Beowulf. The Shire is always a touchstone to which hobbits return, mentally against which they and we measure the rest of Middle-earth. By creating a sense of familiarity and belonging early and then in each of the cultures encountered, we can meet others without feeling estranged. Verisimilitude is maintained even in foreign lands like Mordor. How does one go about creating another world For Tolkien, it begins with a lifelong fascination with language, real and invented. But once there is a language, there must be people to speak the language, a society to support the people, a world in which the people live. The physical, cultural, and ideological components necessary for believability are all found in Middle Earth. Most folks, whether men, hobbits, dwarves, or elves, need the basics of clothing, housing, food, possessions, and other facets of material life, and land needs a topography, geography, and flora and fauna, while overall are astronomy and the life sciences, time, space, and technology. Each of the peoples of Middle Earth has its own language, history, traditions, customs, cultural values, social and familial relationships, governance, economic, legal, and political systems. The world of the Lord of the Rings is ethnically diverse, yet there's a shared system by which behavior and character are judged, much of which derives from medieval yet universal concepts of human experience. Well, the author goes on to study characters, many of them who have flower names. For example, Rosie Cotton is one of the women characters, and Lobelia Sackville Baggins. It would be fun to be able to go through this book with you and look at some of these characters and their personalities. It becomes obvious, though, that Tolkien, like Bilbo, loved flowers, and it seems he wanted to portray the spirit of Shire women through that sweet, occasionally thorny, timeless imagery. A bouquet could be gathered from hobbit female names. Well, you might be interested enough to look up this book, The Plants of Middle Earth, by Dinah Hazel, H-A-Z-E-L-L. So thank you for letting me come to you and express some of the things I'm interested in. And I hope that you once again tune in to Petals and Prose with Helen Cannon.